John basically made the argument that it was prophesied that Jesus would die for the world. Jesus could not die for the world unless he lived sinless. I agree with all that. Therefore, it was impossible for Jesus to sin. That's your argument, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And as he noted, I'm going to say, this argument ignores the difference in foreknowledge and predestination. As you notice, the verse that he quoted reads this way, Acts 2:23. Him being delivered by the determinate counsel, he emphasized that, and then he just sort of didn't talk about this, and foreknowledge of God, ye have taken, and by wicked hands have crucified and slain. So in God's plan to save us, and by the way, the plan of salvation would be correctly the term that Jesus was going to die for our sins, not what are the conditions of salvation. The plan of salvation was that Jesus was going to come and die for our sins. Much of that was predestined. God forced it to happen. Some of it, some of the details were based upon foreknowledge. Let me give you a clear example of what one of the things that would be predestined. The virgin birth. There's no way the virgin birth could happen simply by foreknowledge. It had to be predestined. God had to force it. And we know he did through miraculous means. And a lot of this was predestined. Some of it was done by foreknowledge. That's what this says. Determinate counsel and foreknowledge, John. It takes both. Sometimes some of the details is foreknowledge. Sometimes is predestination. You'll have to prove that the fact that Jesus never sinned was predestinated. Not just the fact that he was going to come and die. This argument ignores the difference in foreknowledge and predestination. Many of you here know my little 7-year-old Down syndrome boy, Wesley, over there. I know for 100% sure that every time I come home from work at night, he's going to say, ping pong. He wants to play ping pong. Every day he does that. As a matter of fact, probably more than a dozen times a day does he say, he'd tell me he wants to play ping pong. Right, Wesley?
Yeah.
Okay. I know he's going to do it. Was that predestination or foreknowledge? Because I know his habits. It's foreknowledge, not predestination. He has a free will choice. He chooses that he wants to play ping pong, yet I know he's going to do it. That's foreknowledge, John. The difference in foreknowledge and predestination is that foreknowledge, you don't cause something to happen, but it's like God can see the future. He doesn't control it. He doesn't make it happen, but he knows it's going to happen. And since he knows for sure it's going to happen, he can count on it happening. He knew Jesus was going to live sinlessly. And because he has perfect foreknowledge, and I don't, I could be wrong about Wesley, perfect foreknowledge, he could count on it happening 100% sure without forcing it to happen. He knew it was going to happen. It was essential to his plan, and he counted on it happening. But it was not predestinated. Number 11, Tommy. Would you go? All right. Now, I'm going to take John's argument, the way he made the argument, and using his same logic, I'm going to prove Calvinism is true in two different cases. Now watch this. He doesn't agree with Calvinism any more than I do. Everybody turn to Isaiah chapter 53, verse 6. Now, John really basically said this. He said it was predestinated that Jesus would die for the sins of us all or the world or something like that. And notice it didn't just say he was predestinated he was going to die, according to John, but he was predestinated he was going to die for the sins of the world. And that's pretty much what Isaiah 53:6 says. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. And the Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. That was a prophecy about the future that Jesus was going to die for the sins of all of us. Everybody in this room, he died for the sins of all of us in this world. Now, John, does that mean that all of us in this room have to sin? Does it? It was predestinated, according to you, that Jesus would die for the sins of the whole world. According to your reasoning, then, that means everybody in the world has to sin. Every sin you committed, since Jesus died for that sin, every one of those sins you had to commit. You had no free will choice. Now, that's your reasoning, John. That's your reason. You said since Jesus, God prophesied that Jesus would live sinlessly, that proves it was predestinated, forced, and Jesus couldn't help but do that. It would be impossible for him not to. According to John's reasoning then, since Jesus, it was prophesied that Jesus would die for the sins of the whole world, that would prove all of us, every sin that we commit, we were predestinated to commit that sin in the sense that we had no free will choice in the matter. Now, that's Calvinism. That's more Calvinism than some of the primitive Baptists that we've debated, isn't it, Tommy? Okay. The truth is, God doesn't force us to sin, but he was smart enough to know ahead of time that we would sin, so he planned and made provision for it. And the truth is, in our issue, God did not force Jesus to live sinlessly, But he was smart enough to know ahead of time that Jesus would live sinlessly. So he used that in his plan to save the world. Here's the second way we're going to prove Calvinism. And I think this is going on and on and on. I can think of example, just about every prophecy in the Bible we could use in this. Jesus foreknew specifically that Judas would be the betrayer. Let's look at that. Now, John, you seem to keep missing this point in the oral debate, in the written debate. You kept confusing this with the prophecy that Jesus would be betrayed in the Old Testament. That's not what I talked about in our written debate. In John 13, 21 and 26, and you can also find this in Matthew 26, I'm skipping some verses here to save time. John 13, 21, Jesus said, "Verily, verily, I say unto you that one of you shall betray me." Now skip down to verse 26. Jesus answered, they were talking about who it might be, if you would have read the rest of that. He said, "He it is to whom I shall give a sop when I have dipped it." And when he had dipped the sop, he gave it to Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon. You can see the same thing in Matthew. Jesus at this point knows that Judas is going to betray him. Is that predestination or foreknowledge? It's foreknowledge. Does that mean that Judas had a choice or did not have a choice about betraying Jesus? No, Judas still had a choice. God didn't take away his free will choice. Judas still had a choice, but God, Jesus, was smart enough here to predict with 100% accuracy his choice. That's foreknowledge. The fact that he could predict it, had foreknowledge, didn't mean Judas didn't have a choice. So the fact that God could predict that Jesus was going to live sinlessly did not mean that Jesus didn't have a choice. And John will agree that Judas had a choice. I had one of the official questions in our written debate. Is it possible for a man to keep from committing a particular sin, for example, Judas's betrayal of Jesus? And John answered, no, Judas had a choice. Because John agrees with us that if anybody has to sin, if they're forced to sin, that's Calvinism. John put up a quote here by Adam Clark and some other quotes, which would prove absolutely nothing. John, I didn't quote, I quoted Matthew Henry in our debate, written debate, not Adam Clark. But I did not quote Matthew Henry as a source of authority like you did these other ones. All it was is I liked the way he said something. And when you're writing a term paper at school, if you like the way somebody says something and you quote them, you get in trouble if you don't give them credit for it. I wasn't trying to use him as authority. I just liked the way he said it. He had a much better way with words than me. So I quoted him, and then I had to give him his credit, or you would have thought it was my own ideas, and that wouldn't be right. Number 15, Tommy. Hit 15 and see if it's still running. Now, let's look at some passages that prove that Jesus had a choice about whether or not he could sin. First, let's look at Hebrews 4:15. It says, "For we have not a high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but within all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin." So Hebrews 4:15 says Jesus was tempted like as we are. Not only does tempted here imply the possibility of sin, but the fact that Jesus was tempted like as we are underscores the fact that he could sin just as we can. If it were impossible for Jesus to sin, then he wasn't really tempted like we are. When we're tempted, is it possible for us to sin? Yes. So if he was tempted like we are, then he was tempted with the possibility of sin, like we are. Temptation without the possibility of sin would certainly be a facade, wouldn't it? And then number 13. In Hebrews 2, verses 17 and 18, the Bible reads, "Wherefore in all things..." How much time, Tommy?
About 6 minutes.
"It behooved him," it's talking about Jesus, "to be made like unto his brethren." Remember that. And what's the reason he was made like his brethren? That he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, so he could be more merciful to us, to make reconciliation for the sins of the people. For in that he himself has suffered being tempted, he is able to succor them that are tempted. Or he's able to empathize with them, or sympathize with them. He understood what they went through, and that's why he was tempted. He was made so that he could be tempted, so that he was made like a man so that he could be tempted, so that he could empathize with us. He would understand what we're going through in his temptation. That sounds like he could sin, right? Or if he couldn't sin, then he really could not succor those that are tempted. He could not empathize with us. He could not be a merciful and faithful high priest. So passages like Hebrews 2, 17 through 18 affirm that Jesus became a man fully. He had all the characteristics of a man. Plus, in addition to that, he was also God. It says Jesus was made like unto his brethren, and goes on to say that Jesus was tempted and is therefore able to succor them that are tempted. Now, John's theory makes a farce of most of this teaching. John doesn't believe Jesus was made like us in regard to temptation or sin, because he believes we can sin, but Jesus couldn't. And so, Jesus was not made like us in regard to temptation, even though the verse says that he was. And then, according to John's position, Jesus really can't empathize with our struggle against sin, because Jesus never had to face the actual possibility of sin as we did. Number 20, Tommy. Hebrews chapter 5, verse 8. If you'll turn there, but here's how the King James reads there. Though he, talking about Jesus, were a son, yet learned he obedience by the things which he suffered. Now, first of all, aren't Jesus' temptations a part of how Jesus learned obedience? I think that's definitely a part of it. And John, if it were impossible for Jesus to disobey, then Jesus didn't really learn to obey. Obedience would have been automatic for him. How does a person learn to obey, Chris, if it's impossible for him to disobey? That just won't work. Number 4, Tommy. Now, do you remember the temptation? Let's read Matthew 4, 1, 8 through 10. There were three temptations, but let's look at the last one. First of all, let's notice the word tempted. Verse 1, then was Jesus led up of the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted of the devil. We skip the first two temptations, and we read 8 through 10. Again, the devil taking him up into an exceeding high mountain, and showeth him all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them, and saith unto him, all these things will I give thee, if you will fall down and worship me. Then said Jesus unto him, get thee hence, Satan, for it is written, thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve. Now, my question for John is, why would Satan even try to get Jesus to sin, and he clearly did try to get him to sin, if it were impossible for Jesus to succumb? Why would Satan even try that if it were impossible for Jesus to sin? But he certainly did try. He certainly thought that Jesus could sin. Do you agree with that, John? John's position makes the temptations of Jesus in this chapter and anywhere else a farce, since Jesus wasn't really tempted by Satan's overtures. Number 23, Tommy. 1 Peter 2, 20-22. Christ is our example in facing sin. For even hereunto were you called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that ye should follow his steps, who did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth. Now, Jesus is here, is said to be our example. We're to follow his steps. And then it says, who did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth. His example was perfection, of course. He never sinned. John and I agree on that. That's our example. That's our goal. That's what we should strive for. We all fall short. But how could he be our example in abstaining from sin if it were impossible for him to sin to start with? Because it's certainly not impossible for us to sin. If he could not sin, if it were impossible for him to sin, then he really could not have been our example in trying to avoid sin. The only way he could have been our example is if he could have sinned, but he didn't sin. And that's what God wants us to do. We could sin, but he wants us not to. I guess I've already talked about that. So, number 24, Thomas. How much time is left now, Tommy? Okay. This issue, John told me, is very important in his brotherhood. A lot of differences. And perhaps we have not had as much talk in our brotherhood talked about this as quite as much. But I feel that this issue is important. Here's why. First of all, this phrase in Hebrews 4:15, was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin, emphasizes Jesus' astounding accomplishment in overcoming sin over the course of his whole life. Now, if you think about it, I want to suggest to you that's the greatest feat in the history of mankind. That's better than anything Houdini ever did. Can you think about that? How often we sin? Every day, multiple times. And then a life of 33 years approximately. He went his whole life without sinning. That's no accomplishment if it was impossible for him to sin, as John's position is. But the fact that it was possible for him to sin, yet he went his whole life and he had to face the temptation, just like Pat and Gary and Alan and Brent, just like we have to, yet he never succumbed to the temptation, that's the greatest achievement ever in the history of mankind. John's position loses sight of that. John's position ignores the greatest feat ever in the history of mankind, what Jesus did. The greatest thing that anybody's ever done, the greatest accomplishment, is to live their whole life without sin. And John's position doesn't recognize that. practically speaking, what is the big difference between Jesus couldn't sin and Jesus didn't sin? We agree he didn't sin. My answer is that it is important to understand the fact that Jesus could have sinned, but didn't, because that leaves us without excuse for our sin. Many people say, I can't help but sin. No, Jesus was tempted like we are with the possibility of sin, and when he overcame sin, that proves, since he's our example, that we can help sin, and whenever we sin, we're responsible for it. John's position doesn't say that. He's not the perfect example in that. Jesus living above sin doesn't do anything for us. People could still say they can't help but sin. My time is over, so I'll let John have the floor. The format of the debate tonight is two 15-minute speeches apiece, and then a bathroom break, and then two more 15-minute speeches. Thank you for coming so much.